I'd like to call to order the Programs, Projects, and Operations Subcommittee, June 9, 2019. Call to order. Before we get started, we have the Open Meetings Act posted on the back of our wall. A copy of the Open Meetings Act, Nebraska Revised Statute 84-1407 through 84-1414 is posted on the back wall of the meeting room. Prior to turning to the agenda for tonight's meeting, I would like to announce the procedure that will be used for this meeting. With respect to each agenda item, the directors first use staff proposals and recommendations. Then the public will be given the opportunity to speak to the item. Lastly, the directors will discuss the item and take action. We ask that the public not interrupt the directors' discussion and action. Thank you. Quorum call.
Fowler.
Here.
Jeff.
Here.
Slepinski.
Here.
Teaser.
Here.
Chairperson.
Aye. Item number four, adoption of agenda.
I'll move.
Second.
Motion to second. Any questions? Roll call.
Jeff?
Yes.
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 Fowler?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye. Item number five, proof of publication. Have proof of publication, which will become part of the permanent meeting. Item number six, review and recommendation of bids received for Platte River Landing Site Restoration. Amanda Grant.
Bill, maybe the map, if you don't mind. Thank you. And I'll just quickly explain what we've got going on. So this is our Platte River Landing recreation area. It's Highway 64 or Ida Street near Valley. And we had a gorgeous thing going here. We worked on it over a number of years. We've had like five phases of work, and it really took a beating during the flood. John mentioned that the park is open, and it is open, but really just this parking area and the boat ramp is open, and O&M's park staff, so in-house, we've done that work to date and got rock down and got things going so we have access to the river. But this bigger part of the recreation area where we had sand volleyball court, we had this winding trail with picnic tables and soccer fields and some nice trees is pretty bad. And we thought it would probably, our guys have so much stuff to do that this is one thing we thought we would try to contract out. So we put together some plans to clean this up and just basically restore it to what it was. There's tons of sediment down here. There's a camper. A lot of the trees got hit with ice. They'll have to be replaced. So we did put that out to bid, and we opened bids on July 2nd. And we had what I thought was pretty good interest, considering everyone is very, very busy with a lot of flood work right now. We had four people at the pre-bid, but we only did get one bid at the bid opening. But that was Valley Corp, and their bid was $284,604 and some change. The engineer's estimate was just over $325,000, so we still feel like we got a good bid. We have a good working history with Valley Corp. We've worked with them on a number of things in the past, and currently we have a number of things going on. So we are recommending that we take that bid. And I guess I should mention this, all of the in-house work we did to clean up this site is reimbursable by FEMA, and so is this contract work. So 75% of this would come back to us reimbursed from FEMA to clean up the site. But with that, any questions, I'd be happy to answer, and we're recommending that we execute a contract with Valley Corp for their bid of $284,000+.
Thank you, ma'am.
I move adoption of the
staff recommendation. Do you have a second?
Second.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to this side? Directors?
I've got a question on that project. Is that a super low area according to the river level?
It's certainly floodplain.
A project that we've had to redo?
Well, just by its location, you know, it's a rec area on the river and a boat access. So it does flood, and we get sediment in there, and it is just low. We can't fill it, though, because it's floodway. So.
Well, you were saying FEMA was involved, so I'm just assuming maybe that, did anybody ever take a look at maybe just trying to raise that area 3 or 4 feet?
We probably couldn't do that without some major mitigation because it's floodway. We have filled, and we've we've put in a restroom that's elevated, and we've done a few little things. That's about all we're going to be able to do without mitigating. But we try to design things so we know they're going to flood. You know, the riprap, we have a lot of riprap on the banks there. The boat ramps just always need to be cleaned out. That's just the way it is. Spray down the playgrounds.
Welcome to the river.
Yeah.
There's also a high water channel that flows to the north along our northern border of the park. So, you know, it's one of those things where we kind of become a little bit of an island. And very heavily used park. Got people constantly, you know, calling me, wanting to know about the airboating. And when's the, now we got the playground is not quite open, is it?
No, we closed everything but the boat ramp and the parking is closed just because it's just so much sediment and the trail washed out.
We have a soccer field there that is starting to draw some attention, being used by some clubs that are coming down there during the weeknights. And so the park is our busiest park, or in fact our only park on the Platte River, basically.
Flat.
I had a question. You said the engineers estimated this to be $325,000. Who are the engineers that estimate?
Well, it's Big Muddy Workshop is the company that's done most of the design out there.
Okay. And one more thing. Is because we're talking budget today anyway, where does a non-budgeted item like this fit into the 2019 budget? Where does the money come from to do this?
So we knew we would have to do something at this park. And we knew we would get some money back. So there are estimates in this budget. Those, of course, went out before the July 2nd opening. And so they're low, I think, was based on what I had thought. But we did our best. All of this FEMA cleanup work, we have tried to put in the budget. And we've tried to put in what we think it will cost and what we think we'll get back. But it's still just a work in progress. We're meeting with them, like, almost every day this week. And so...
Certainly. I'm assuming we have to pay it before FEMA pays us back.
We
right?
do.
And so there could be a considerable delay before we get any reimbursement, if at all, from FEMA.
That has happened in the past.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, and we've had it happen for a three-year period before. I think that's the longest we've gone is 3 years to get paid back. But what I found, and they are really trying to be proactive, and we're trying to be very proactive to just get things done, wrapped up, get the paperwork in, and then there's not much... reason for it, you know, to
right.
We can't say for sure, but we can try to not give them reasons. Yeah.
But this is a very public facing project. We got to get this fixed up. A lot of people use that, as I recall.
Yeah, it's a lot of people also eat lunch there from Valmont. It's a really nice place to go, just get away from everything, but not now, but it used to be. Yeah,
great people watching, actually.
One thing should be noted, this park is actually higher than the busiest park at Two Rivers. The camper park right on the riverbank floods a lot sooner than this area floods. So.
Is it open now or not?
The boat ramp?
Just
the
it boat is. Ramp. Yeah, just like...
Usable, but not in
we
good shape.
Put... well, if you want to go back to the picture, we put up some some temporary fence. I'll show you what... Thank you, Bill. So this is the additional overflow parking, and then this is the soccer fields and volleyball court playground. So you can drive in, park, use the boat ramp, and then we just put a fence here so that people don't take the try to, and it's full of sediment too, but just tried to get the boat ramp going at least.
Amanda, the scope of the work that's going to be done, it's removing the sediment, the trees.
Trees and sand.
And the concrete's going to be replaced. And
there's the trail was limestone, so
okay.
Trail replacement, tree for sure, tree debris and sand. And then we have a camper that showed up that's on pieces, so that sort of thing. And then we lost a picnic table, a grill, and an interpretive sign. Sand volleyball court needs to be cleaned out, and then trees. We have a number of trees that had been, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years old that will die if we don't replace them. And I'm trying to think, that's about it. There's some riprap work as well along that bank with the picnic tables, there's some riprap that washed out that needs to be replaced.
Thank you.
Other questions from directors? Roll call.
Sapinski?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye.
Thanks, Amanda. Item number 7, review and recommendation of the Water Sustainability Fund grant application for airborne electromagnetic surveys. Power ordered from Jim.
Canio will work.
Canio.
Canio.
All right, good evening. Jim Canio is here with Aqua Geo Frameworks. He was the contractor that helped set up and then prepare the results for the past AEM surveys that we've done. So what we're going to talk about tonight is to go over kind of what we learned from the flights we did last year. That's the report we just got in from Jim. And then we'll talk about kind of based on what those results were, what the next step might be in looking at a new grant. So I think we're going to go through the PowerPoint presentation here. So I'll just touch on, I think that moves forward, doesn't it, if you do that?
Yeah, I believe it will. Yeah.
Okay, there we are.
So we're doing good. Good evening, everyone. On behalf of my partners, Jared Abraham and Ted Ash, we appreciate having the chance to provide this work to you, and we're here to report out on the results. There are many other people that have worked on this, Paul being one of them, and Katie Camera from ENRA, the Eastern Nebraska Water Resources Assessment Team. So we hope you enjoy what you see tonight. It was a very complicated survey. The great amount of detail that comes out of these surveys will no doubt have a good impact on your groundwater management. So I'm going to, real quick, I know time is limited, we're going to go through the history of the AEM studies as related to the Papio Missouri River NRD. We're going to talk about the objectives of this survey, how the AEM determines the geology, what the results are, in particular the reconnaissance lines, and then the Dacaima block. We'll talk about the key findings, and then as we go along, and definitely at the end, Paul will step in and talk about his plans. So for those of you, I'm going to start here real quick. How many of you got to see when we were flying last year? Anybody? One, two. Very good. It's not something you see every day. So it definitely is a sophisticated piece of equipment. I'll go through it as we go forward. These are the existing AEM flight lines that we had from previous surveys. We originally started all the way back in 2007 with Ashland block down here when I was at the USGS. And that block was strictly a concept. Let's go collect about a township in size, see how it works for determining the geology in the area. All the other flight lines through 2018, that would be the 15 and 16 flight lines, are based off of that initial survey. So what do you get as a result of this? The report is extensive. Everything you see in this PowerPoint is just a small part of what's in the report as far as figures, maps, et cetera. But the important part here is we managed to map this entire area in just a few days. It's important to understand that you share a border, as you know, with Lower Platte North NRD, and their flight lines are part of the maps that we created. And the reason for this is the ability to interpret the data across political boundaries is very important. Political boundaries, where information stops, generally leads to an issue with understanding the geology that's underneath it. So they also collected data in 2018. We interpreted it all together because that's just the way the geology is laid down. The Dacaima block was a particular feature that the NRD wanted to have mapped in great detail. It's called a block flight because there's many closely spaced AEM lines together, while the rest of the district is a reconnaissance line.
So the objectives, obviously to improve the hydrogeology understanding of the area. We call it a hydrogeologic framework. We provide a reconnaissance level map, and that is the widely spaced flight lines, as well as a strong 3D block flight of the Kama area. We look at the extent of the glacial aquifer, the Dakota aquifer, and also the quaternary aquifers that you have in the districts. We really want to understand the hydrologic connections between groundwater and surface water. We also want to understand how the potential for groundwater recharge may exist in your district. So here it is, 608 line miles. The approximate cost was $230,000 total. I don't know what the break was. I don't remember between WSF funds and the district. It's 60-40.
Got about 60-40, yep.
So, but because NRA had so many line miles to bid to our vendors that supply the geophysical equipment, we had the ability to provide an additional 50% of the base flight lines to you folks at no charge. So you ended up getting a lot more than what you had planned on with no additional cost.
So what, real quick, Jim,
sure.
What Jim means by that is that originally we thought we were just going to get, I'll go back.
I'm not sure why.
Originally we thought we were just going to be able to do this area. And so everything you see north of that was added because of better cost data or better cost from their vendors.
Yeah. And I might point out real quickly, we went out and selected bids from all the vendors that are available to do this work. So this was a low-cost bid. Katie Cameron was part of the technical team that did this work. It's on record. You can get a copy of how the bidding went. Okay. I'm a geologist. I'm not a geophysicist. My two partners are excellent geophysicists. When I look at resistivity profiles, and that's these colors along a flight line. So going from west to east, this is a flight line. The helicopter flies along, and what it's doing is sending a signal into the earth. And then based on the strength of the signal from the energized rocks from that and the time that it comes back to the helicopter, it makes a resistivity profile like this. Warmer colors are sands and gravels interpreted. The cooler colors are shales and clays, like the Dakota shale. You could have clay up here in the till from the glacial deposits. What we do is then look at this, and then we do the interpretations. You'll see something like KD here or a Q here. Q is quaternary sediment. In this case, it ends up being till. The KD is the Cretaceous Dakota. And that's all fine and good, but that's not necessarily valuable to you or Paul or anybody else. Let's take this and turn it into an interpretation. We take those colors and we compare it to all of the ground truth, which could be other geophysical surveys, of which there are few, or boreholes, including geophysical borehole logs. So now that it's turned into real rocks and something that you've seen on the ground surface, or if any of you have been around a well that's drilled, what you see is for the quaternary materials, the browns that you see are coarse gravels materials. The yellows are sands. The kind of tannish pink color here is marginal aquifer material, mostly silt with some sand. You could probably get a stock well or maybe a domestic well out of it. And then this blue happens to be clay-rich material. That's non-aquifer material. So when you see the blues and the marginal aquifer materials, groundwater flow is restricted. So where it's not restricted is the yellow and the browns. When you get to the Cretaceous Dakota, and that's this green rocks here, the darker greens are shales. They are restrictive to groundwater flow. But the sands and sandstones are the lighter green. Where they're in contact with each other, so this yellow here with this light green color here, there is a hydrologic connection in the subsurface. When you go over here to where Elkhorn River is, where you see the yellow in contact with the Dakota all the way up to the channel of the Elkhorn, where it's brown and yellow, coarse and sand materials, there is a hydrologic connection to the river right there. So if you put a well into this and extract water, it is in hydrologic connection with the river. Any questions on that? So one of the things that comes out of these profiles, and this is a reconnaissance line, is where have I restrictions to groundwater flow? This is really important, especially for the modeling that you're doing, especially for water supply for the various towns that you're responsible for. If you go along right here, this is nicely connected. There's a little restriction right here just by the geometry, but it is not closed off. And you're hydrologically connected to about right here, and that's where it's cut off. So that can give you a distance from a stream. It shows that at least along this profile, and we'll get to this at the end, why it's important to fill more information is. But just looking at this one line, that's where the river is isolated from the rest of the groundwater system that has water in it, and you can get a well in it. Any questions before I go forward? Okay. So you take these profiles and you build what's called a fence diagram. You'll notice that on the Lower Platte North side of the river, they intentionally flew block flights. They wanted to understand everything there was to know about hydrologic connection, the amount of groundwater in storage, all of the major features of understanding a hydrogeologic framework. Because of the information that we wanted to collect for your district and the amount of funding that we had, we did a combination of both. So Takema was a block flight. Everything else is reconnaissance flights. And reconnaissance flights are valuable. It shows you where you want to collect more data later if you need it. All of this comes together, and as you can see, that you can see similar hydrologic characteristics. As you go underneath the Elkhorn and Platte Rivers, you can see that there's a strong hydrologic connection in this area. When you get down to the south here, the blue that you see here and over along the Missouri in places, that is the Pennsylvanian limestone that you see getting crushed up, put on roads, et cetera, around here. That's not a very good aquifer. So we've mapped all the way down to that bedrock. So total thickness of quaternary deposits on the reconnaissance lines, as much as 400 foot of thickness. That's the darker colors that you see over here. But remember, this does not mean sand and gravel. It means all of it, the non-aquifer material, sands, coarse gravels, and marginal aquifer materials. That all makes up the quaternary deposits. You'll see that it's mostly glacial deposits that go into this area. So saturated thickness of the same. Obviously, where the water table is conducive to this, the thicker sections of saturated thickness are away from the Elkhorn and the Platte Rivers. Again, up to 200 feet right up here in that corner of saturated thickness.
Right. So I guess the...
Go ahead.
Go back to that one. The layout of that one was a little bit... One of our intentions with the first reconnaissance flight was to say, do we need to go to the level that, say, Lower Platte North did on the other side where they had such close lines because that costs more? So we kind of kept down the cost of the first survey by looking at what can we find out. I think the most interesting thing we found out was that potentially this sand and gravel that isn't part of the actual Platte Elkhorn River sands and gravels, it's an older outwash from the glaciers is kind of what we're thinking. That does exist, and it is in contact with the, as Jim was showing, with the river aquifer material. So finding that out is pretty interesting. I'll explain a little bit more about why that is. But so one of the goals in looking at this the way we did was to see if we need to go to this next step that we're going to talk about tonight, which is more detail than these 3 mile grid.
Yeah, we'll show a profile in a minute that shows exactly what you're talking
about. Hold on.
Whoop.
It went really fast.
Speed reading. We're doing good.
There you go.
There we go. Okay. So the reason why it's important to understand some of this stuff, and we'll go through these next maps rather quickly, but I think you're getting the taste of it, is it's not homogeneous. The heterogeneity of the subsurface of this district is similar to other districts, but it's interesting. The NRD system, and I used to work for an NRD, was designed to take care of that local control part because not every district is the same. You share boundaries, but it does change as you go along the flight lines. So the Dakota surface, this is important because the Dakota is starting to become more and more important of an aquifer. You'll see that at Takema. Takema's got a lot of Dakota aquifer material that you're utilizing for wells, but it is not everywhere. On this map, where you see it's turned to white, that's the extent of the Dakota. It was deposited, but eroded off. It's probably eroded off by the glaciers. So when you look at this stuff, you can see it starts to come over here, and then it's not there anymore. As you go west into Lower Platte North, it does continue. It just gets deeper as it goes down gradient. The thickness of the Dakota, as you can see, it thins to the east and gets thicker to the west, which is exactly what we were just talking about, where it's deposited and eroded off. Why this map is important, here's Takema up here. It's kind of in that medium range, but people are getting water out of it, but it's mostly sand and sandstone dominant up there. So it's not only how thick it is, but how do the materials change as you move from one area to the other. Saturated thickness of the Cretaceous along the reconnaissance lines. Some of the thickest stuff is right here, especially to the south, and it thins as you go to the north and west. Okay, so real quick, let's talk about the Takema and its hydrologic connection with the Missouri River. This is really interesting. We suspected this when we started the studies years ago. Now we've got empirical data to show this. Here's that Dakota sandstone material, and we're doing the interpretive profile, and it goes right into connection with the Missouri alluvial system. What's interesting is this thickness of all the muds that you do find when you tromp around in the Missouri River valley floor. You actually map this where the muds are, and this gives a semi-confining condition. All that means is the water is under partial pressure underneath those clays. So the direct connection to the river is most likely over here where those clays are no longer found. So right here, if any surface water that's right here above this clay has to run to the sides to get down into the aquifer. It's not going to go straight through. It doesn't take much clay to short-circuit a hydrologic system and lower the transmissivity. But this is also, at Takema, you've got a great aquifer right here. Most of the wells are completed in it. And we understand there's the water quality issue, which you can talk about or not.
Go ahead. So we do have, our next item on the agenda is to work a little bit more with Takema, and what you'll see, I can maybe just kind of talk about what you're seeing here then, is that basically they have wells, you know, right on the north side of town. They have two operating wells right now that go down into this sandstone. That was part of a pump test we did. So that thing pumped at 450 gallons a minute out of what we wouldn't necessarily consider big sands and gravels in the sandstone, but it did that for 24 hours or for 48 hours. Mm-hmm. So that's a heck of a good well they've got. It's just the issue of what happens when it's pulling that water down. We actually found that it was pulling water from some of these upper materials too, and that was bringing the nitrates down into the well potentially. So that's one of the ideas. Now the wells we'll talk about that they're looking at putting a cap in today are just over here in the valley area, but they also have a cap, like Jim was showing. So it's important, what we're doing with those wells is basically sealing them at where that cap is at. So if there is any polluted water at the top, it's not going to make it down to the bottom of the well. So it's kind of an added protection layer for the well. So go ahead. I don't, it so far, it the stuff that's at the surface isn't really helping us explain why the nitrates are at or near the surface. They've gotten into this upper soil at times. What it is showing us is that this upper soil isn't necessarily highly conductive, so it's not
right. It's
not taking pollutants and bringing them down into the groundwater very fast. That's kind of occurring slowly over time. But where or why those pollutants came from, it doesn't tell us much of that about that. We're looking at it does. I mean, we know that does might. We know that does move. I mean, in this case, it's going to move from the higher elevation aquifer down to the Missouri Valley. So it's fairly unlikely that water is moving from the Missouri Valley back into
right.
the Dakota
That's
aquifer.
That's correct. Yeah.
Because all that water's.
There's head against it.
Just like water moves in a pipe, it's pushing it down basically this way to the east. But the fact that they're in connection does allow for a sharing. If there was pollutants in either one, it allows for a sharing of those.
Question, I guess, along those lines, is channelization of the Missouri River prevent recharge of the ground?
As far as mechanical channelization, where they've removed like that thin clay and gotten down into the sand and gravel, that's a direct connection right there. So,
there's so
if
much,
that's what you mean.
Yeah. What we found in the Missouri is there's so much, if you think about it, surface area for connection to occur between the river and the groundwater. It happens very fast. It's just, like we went out this year, groundwater levels were up 7 feet. Why is that? It's because the river's up 7-8 feet. I mean,
yeah,
it happens within the same season, within the same week sometimes.
And don't be surprised at the fall water levels. Often when you get a flood event where it's pushing the water into the groundwater, you get what's called bank storage. It's a phenomenon that it fills fast, but then once you take that head off, then the transmissivity of the sediments slow it down going back. So you may see an effect from the floods this year over a fair period of time. So watch for that. This is it in 3D. It's a small little 3D block. You asked maybe where this is coming from. It's probably coming from where it is incised along the creeks. You can see some of this material is near the surface, and it goes right into the Dakota. The thing to do would be to take a land use map, like we talked about, and lay it, drape it over the top of this. But because we didn't fly a very big area, it could very well be coming from other areas and traveling by groundwater gradients into this area near your wells. Mm-hmm. So thickness of the quaternary block and the decama, you can see how thin, where it gets light-colored like this. These wells, Decama Creek and Mud Creek, have cut into that glacial till and thinned them out, and in many places that's where it's coming in quickly to contact.
It's really close
contact.
To Dakota.
Yeah. Potential recharge. We looked at everything and blocked out areas where there's good recharge to very good recharge. Where it's not colored, like right here, there's almost no recharge. There's a lot of clay material in there, so that was left out. But from 0 to 3 feet, where most of the action is, for recharge, and our maps go deeper than that, but we're just showing you an example tonight. These would be areas where you could potentially have that nitrogen coming in.
So we'll be able to use this information as part of the drinking water protection plan. We'll take where we think water can infiltrate pretty well into the soils. We'll overlay that with, okay, how deep is it to the soils, those thin areas. If those two kind of match up, maybe that's a hot spot or an area where we are potentially seeing issues occur.
So we've already seen the thickness of the Dakota for the reconnaissance lines. Here it is in the Takema area. This is the thickest material there. Again, sand sandstone will yield water to a well, but clay-rich shale material will not. So
and
that's
kind of that, when you see it here in the 32, yeah, but in that map, it does show that, you know, most of this thicker section is the sandstone. And if you were to actually look at where the cities of Tecumseh's wells are at, they're at or near these deeper spots. So they, how they knew those were good spots, but they kind of knew those were good spots for wells after probably drilling test holes and checking them, and that's, you know, they happen to end up in those locations. So the good news is they've got good wells that draw groundwater to them fairly easily, so they've got good quantity. By drawing that groundwater to them, they're also potentially drawing contaminants towards their wells too. So go ahead.
Okay. So the next slide is a three-dimensional voxel. It's a volume of material. This is how we get to figuring out how much groundwater is in storage, et cetera. But we build these things, and all of the materials are represented in it. So then we cut away so that you can view looking down into the Tecumseh block and see how exactly what you were just talking about with the well. Here's the well right here. You can see this Dakota sand sandstone is right here, and right above it you do have some sand, but you'd have to again look at it in profile and see how it is as far as the connection goes. But this is how we look at it in comparison to the wells that are in, and their logs, they compare extremely well. You can see how this thins out. The creek is in the squiggly line in the blue, and you can see right here where you have pretty good surface groundwater interaction. So
this is also a good example. This is the difference between what they do with block flights, where they can actually make a 3D representation of everything, versus the reconnaissance line. If we just done lines every mile or 3 miles like we did down there, you wouldn't see this level of detail. You just got lines next to each other, kind of.
So, but also because of the ability to do a block flight, we can give you an estimate of groundwater and storage for each material. So when you look at this, and this has been something that we spend a lot of time on, if you look at just the aquifer volume material, and this is the quaternary stuff, you've got basically 1.5 billion acre feet of material there. Then you just do, it's pretty straightforward math, but you got to get the right multipliers in here. So let's just look at the aquifer material that's there, because there was almost no course, just a little bit. By the time you look at just the aquifer, we're down to 17,000 acre feet. You take that times the average porosity, and now you're at 3,428 acre feet of storage volume, actual groundwater and storage. And then because of the way the aquifer works, when you pump a well, you don't get all the water. You get a small percentage of it. It's called the specific yield. So by the time you add that in, you're looking at about 343 acre feet at any particular time. It doesn't mean you pump 343 acre feet and you're done. It just means, depending on conditions and the side lateral movement of water into this area, that particular time period for this material, static, there's 343 acre feet of drainable water out of the aquifer. The same calculation is done for the Dakota, but look at the difference. By the time you get the Dakota done, you're at 3,000 acre feet for the same extractable water. So that's part of the reason so many people are getting into the Dakota. It's just not saturated, or there's not enough quaternary material in that upper area. They're getting their wells deeper. Again, potential recharge along the reconnaissance lines. Now, this is literally along the lines. It's showing you, but we had to make it big enough so you could see. This gives you a hint of where the really good recharge is versus just okay recharge versus almost no recharge along those flight lines. So this is part of the planning tools that we used to start setting up for the potential of doing the next round of investigation. And we can just go through the key findings real quick, and then Paul's going to talk. But the bottom line is we had exceptionally good fidelity between the boreholes and the airborne electromagnetic signals and interpretation that we did. This is not unusual. It tends to be pretty common in Nebraska after all these years, 12 years of doing this. We have the technique honed down to where it's very good. Interpreted geologic contacts, we were able to make all of the contacts identifiable throughout the AEM project all the way down to the Pennsylvanian. We feel that our estimates of the amount of those materials is identified, especially at Takema, but along the flight lines, it's strictly a this is where the contact is, and this is Dakota material, this is the glacial till, et cetera. Resistivity has been pretty standardized. It's a range of ohm meter values. So like the non-aquifer materials, less than 12 ohm meters, marginal is 12 to 20, aquifer is 20 to 50, and the coarse is greater than 50. And that's held up also pretty well with not only the work we do, but other historical geologic maps. We did have significant variability along the profiles, and that makes part of the reasoning for filling in on the reconnaissance lines into a block flight. You don't have to go far, and it changes along a profile. And if you get a chance, look at the profiles and go from one to the other, and you'll see that it changes quickly. The recharge zones I just showed you, and now I'm going to give it to Paul, and he can talk about this. Fair enough?
Sounds good. So, like I said, we did the framework study to kind of give us an idea of if we needed to take this any further or not. If we hadn't found anything of connections or of interest, maybe we kind of just leave it where it lies. But there's a lot of reasons between the recharge. So a lot of those areas are fairly vulnerable when you think about there's only 4 feet to groundwater and there's sands and gravels out there. As our population grows and more industry comes in, we've got a fairly vulnerable groundwater supply. So we want to understand that the best we can. There's also things with Wellhead, with other communities. So we didn't talk much about the communities in this. Maybe I'll show the proposed flight area first. And they're just in the background here. But you would have Fremont actually has wells in our district. And they're expanding that. They put one in. They're actually, from what I understand, they're considering doing one of those horizontal wells like Lincoln has out there because they want more capacity too as time goes on. So what we'd like to do, they'd be required to give us a groundwater model and prove that they're not impacting other people around them or other uses around them. That groundwater model is only as good as what data we started with. Like, it'd be kind of like going out and designing a bridge without any topographic survey. So that's kind of what this data is going to provide us in that area. The other key thing I kind of want to talk about is through our drought mitigation study. I know I've mentioned on this a time or two about how we would look at this area. Just to give you an idea of how quickly things came up or how connected they are, the groundwater between the two rivers rose 5 feet in a day when the flood came through. So there was some flood water actually stored between the two rivers in all that groundwater. It still ended up flooding lots of stuff. But the fact that it's that connected and that works that well together, just think of it if we'd have used that's just 5 feet of water. What if we had over here, we have people that virtually aren't drilling really any wells. They're just drilling it in the upper sands and gravels that they know are next to the river. That's what most of the wells are in now. There's another 80 to 90 feet of sand. We could potentially put a well in there, use that water to supply the river when it's low or when it's in drought conditions. Some of the water, we're not going to make up the flow of the river, but that's one of the ideas that's floated out there for mitigating drought. So I just wanted to point those things out. And then that kind of goes through the reasons when we went through. So we have put together a draft grant application for water sustainability funds. The total cost that Jim has provided an estimate for these line miles was $700,000. So we'd be asking the WSF to provide 60% of that or $420,000. And we'd budget the remainder over the next couple years. Again, it's an investment in better data, but I think we've found lots of potential uses or ways that data is going to help us in the long run. I guess with that, that's where we get to questions, and that pretty much covers everything that I went over in my memo and recommendation anyway. So.
Thanks, Scott.
Yep.
Can we have a motion on this item?
Staff recommendation.
Second. We have a second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
What if the Water Sustainability Fund doesn't approve?
We probably wouldn't have to move forward at this time then.
Which comes first? We have to get the money from the Water Sustainability Fund before we go forward?
No, in the past we've waited to make sure that the Water Sustainability Funding grant money was approved.
Yeah.
And then we set up the contract with Jim and his company to go get the best vendor out there.
Previous surveys that we've done and the data that's been collected, has it been graphed just exactly like what you showed us?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
The previous surveys that have been done in years past, has it also been graphed exactly like what you've shown us, or is that new technology?
No, it's the technology is very similar. It is very comparable. Matter of fact, they came out with a new system 2 years ago that, frankly, we gave them input back because we've been part of the team over the years to test some of this equipment, that it wasn't as good as what we liked, and we went back to a previous system. So we're always evaluating what the better equipment is for the project. Does that answer your question?
Very close. One more thing, Paul. Can you point to any projects that we've used this information for in the past?
So I did the area down by Springfield. We actually just used it as part of the drinking water management plan for Springfield. This is still all preliminary data, but basically what it helped us do is without that data, we would have run a model that would have increased the size of Springfield's wellhead protection area by like 3 times. Just basically it wasn't accurate enough to show us where the water was coming from and at what speed and stuff. So we put the new AEM data in there, and it dropped it back to about maybe 1.3 times what the current wellhead protection area is. So we found a lot of use in putting this into a model, specifically if we're trying to ask questions that are pretty detailed when it comes down to a community or a town or something, that we've used that quite a bit.
It's still a considerable amount of money. I just want to make sure that we're getting. Is it helpful?
Yeah. And then I think the other thing that where it's become helpful is the whole water quality question. You know, where is our groundwater supplies, and how connected are they? What could we expect to happen if we had, in some places we do have water quality issues, but you know, what happens if we continue to see problems arise? At least we'll know in the future if water quality problems pop up here, where could they be going next, I guess, is part of this mapping.
If I may, if it's of interest to you, the Lower Loop in 2016 also did AEM mapping for Columbus and their managed aquifer recharge project. The results of that, viewing as a large block white area, allowed them to develop where the managed aquifer recharge points were going to be, and they're actually working on building it now based on that information. It saved them a lot of effort on engineering and estimating costs.
Okay.
trying to get it straight with the greater the porosity of the substrate, is that where you may have more probability of contaminants?
Yeah. Well, porosity is the ability to store water in the sediments. You can have a high porosity and cementation could cut down on the hydraulic conductivity. So it's a combination of the storage and the ability to transmit water. So what we're giving you is an estimate of the amount of water in storage, and then like you were saying, they did the aquifer test for you, and they found out that it flowed freely between those sediments. So it's a characterization of what those sediments can do. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, very, very much so, it helps. And then the other thing, I want to know if they could be drilling at an angle to, and you were saying Fremont may. I think that's very important for us to have this type of study outside our jurisdiction.
Well, I think Fremont is drilling in our district just because we have that little piece that's right next to it. So they already have their well field in our district. What they're thinking about is putting in higher capacity wells, kind of like what, you know, Lincoln has, what they call the horizontal well. It's a big vertical shaft with, like, wheels on a spoke on a bike that go out and suck the water in. And it just yields more water for one well to pump. But so they would need, they're going to need better data than what we currently have to tell us what would a well like that do to the local groundwater table, to the river, things like that.
What would be the downsides if we chose not to do this and spend any more money, or if we just said, well, okay, well, we know enough. Give us a good downside to that choice.
Okay. I think right what we would do, not it's not necessarily a direct one-for-one trade-off. I think the other thing we can continue to do would be to go get some additional boreholes, like actually physically go out in the field, drill something, look at what we find, and make sure that what we're seeing on this map is fairly accurate. We could even do like before somebody engineered a well field that was going to pump water into the Platte River, they would put in a well and test it, see how well it pumps, what it can do. So those are things that can be done too. And
which is cheaper? Is to drill a test well and check it? Or
you could never afford to drill enough wells to characterize what you see here. That's a virtual borehole every 50 feet along those profiles.
So what he's saying is, yeah, the boreholes only give us information in that one spot.
That's what I was kind of getting at. I mean, yeah. Is this something that's going to be just very invaluable all the way down the road?
I think it crosses lots of boundaries of ways we can use it is the issue.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Yes. Fowler?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure, yes.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Item number 9. Review and recommendation on professional service agreement with the Platte River Bridge Trail Project, Eric Williams. That was 8.
I know. You're right. That was 7. This is 8. This is the well water control.
Yeah.
I know that was. Yeah, if you could chew once or whatever.
We're on 8. We're on 8. Sorry. Review and recommendation.
Yeah, I can make that more points.
Area.
Oh, would it?
8. All right. We currently have an agreement with the city of Tecama for assisting them in the development of their drinking water protection plan. We're able to do that because they are in a phase 2 area where we've identified some high nitrates. We've kind of had a suspicion that there was this issue with the wells. Basically, when a well is drilled in prior to 2014, when they changed the rules a little bit, so all of Tecama's wells are older than that, When they drilled that well, basically they drilled it bigger than they needed to. They put a casing in, which is what the pump goes into that sucks the water up. The issue is on the outside of that casing, they have to backfill that in with something. Usually that's just sand and gravel that's backfilled because it's the easiest thing to fill with and to fill all the voids around that, that casing. When they do that, potentially leaves that as a pathway for water that may be at the top of the groundwater to get sucked down into the bottom where the well's at. And we think that's occurring here because these are some of the Tecama, in Tecama, the area, these are some of the only groundwater wells around are the actual municipal wells. There's not like, at least in the hills around there, there's not irrigation wells sitting out there. There's not lots of other old wells. So we think these are the only straws, if you will, that have broken the seal between the upper groundwater in cases and the lower groundwater. So that's why Tecama looked at going ahead and in addition to their drinking water plan, going for an environmental trust grant. They were able to get that, so they'll be that'll be providing a lot of the funding. So what this project would actually do is actually take one of the municipal wells that the city has. They'll actually, the contractor will pull the pump out, go down into that well, at the part where they know that there's clay around the well at that location, they'll drill holes in the casing and pump grout out into that. So it would actually seal the outside of the well from water going down through that outside. And that basically prevents the contaminated water at the surface from reaching the water at the bottom of the well.
They like go down so far, hit that clay, and then they just smash material around that.
Yeah, they've already done a test hole to figure out this is exactly where the clay is at. This is exactly where we need to put our seal at, because they had to do that and then submit anytime you actually do construction or modify a public water supply well, you have to submit it to the state for review and approval. So they're going through that. So we're proposing just to help them pick out $10,000 of that cost, which would bring, we're already paying $7,500 for the actual planning, the drinking water plan, where we meet with the community, come up with kind of twofold. The community will help solve maybe some of the nitrate issues that are going on, if that's the case. This is an actual physical project that will help protect the well in the future. So, and we were already able to show a little bit of that. This may go down to the map real quick there, Bill. Okay, so Tecama does has five wells right now. This one is inactive because of high nitrate issues, so they actually can't pump from that one. This is the one we did the pump test. You see spikes in nitrates in that one. Like, after it's pumped for a long enough period of time, it's pulling the nitrates in. Basically, in the community here, there's no treatment, so dilution is a solution. So if this well is pumping at 2 parts per million and this well is pumping at 12, you mix them together and your community has a water supply below 10 parts per million, right? We're hoping to kind of change that as it goes. So basically, if Tecama got to the point where mixing didn't work, they're up a creek without a paddle. So helping these wells so that they can maintain lower nitrate levels will prolong their ability to keep providing safe drinking water. But so this is the well we're actually working on at the fire station. So it is in the Missouri Valley alluvium, like I pointed out before on that one map. And part of the issue with it, too, we didn't find any other active wells right next to it that could be the problem. Well, that's in the registered wells. The city did inform us that they had three smaller wells around there prior to the 1950s. Well, when they abandoned those in the 50s, they just cut them off and put a steel cap or steel plate on the top. So anything that, any casing or any material that it had is allowing water to go right through those two. So we're, This project will also, it'll not only fix the current active community well, it'll reabandon or pump grout where it needs to be for those other three abandoned wells. So kind of protecting this whole area, if you will, from nitrate leaching.
So just that extra space around the pipe, that pulls in that much nitrate?
Yeah, because it's so close to the well, and it's, like I said, it's sand and gravel, so it's moving the water down through there. It does it a little bit of time. I was amazed.
And this works? I mean, you've seen this work elsewhere?
They have done this in probably only two other towns in different places, and they have seen, they've been able to measure the nitrate levels from their pre-project. They've been able to measure them go down or not become an impact. It's still kind of in the preliminary phases, because even though I mentioned in 2014 we changed the standards for a new well to be drilled, we haven't necessarily changed the standards for an old well to be abandoned. So today we still basically put that cap at the top of a well that's abandoned and leave everything below. Now it's going to cost more money if everybody has to abandon the well by putting the seal at where it's needed. And in some cases it's not really needed. You know, if this was sand and gravel all the way down, capping the well wouldn't make a difference. But the fact that we have clay and we kind of have water perched at the, we have water perched at the top and then cleaner water at the bottom, that's why this works in this situation.
Thanks, Paul. We can have a motion.
Motion to accept. Staff recommendation. Staff recommendation.
Second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
Larry? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, Paul, is it known how close Tecama might be flirting with the federal standards?
They've been able to, I think the only way they've been doing, they've been able to figure out by trial and error a system of, I can only pump that well for a day, I need to shut it off for a day, turn it back on. So they've got a system between these five wells of keeping their water tower filled. I don't see, since they shut the main one off, the other ones just seem to spike. By that I mean they'll be fine at like 5 parts per million, and all of a sudden they'll jump up to 15 for a while. And that's also indicative of this movement down through the well. But as long as they keep doing that, they'll be fine. So I don't see a long-term trend of the nitrate just continuing to go up and up and up, and all of a sudden they're going to be in problem. What it does do is, if we're able to fix a couple of the wells, it probably allows them to do more maintenance, things that they should be doing anyway right now, except that they have to keep jumping from one well to the other and don't have any downtime to do anything.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Fowler?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Sikorsky?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye. Now we're on number 9. Eric, you're
right. So this is the next agreement for the U.S. Highway 34 bridge and walking trail. Give the map on that one. Just as a reminder, this is the bridge that will be installed on the east side of the northbound lanes, roughly between Bellevue and Plattsmith. Back in January, we approved the programmatic agreement with Nebraska Department of Transportation, and the NRD is acting as the lead agency in a 6-agency collaboration to get this project constructed. The piers were built when the bridge was constructed, the girders were placed by NDOT, and we have now been negotiating the scope and fee for the design of the trail itself following the selection of Schemmer. You approved sending notification to NDOT to select Schemmer as that consultant. And so what we have is, the entire agreement is 83 pages. What you were provided was just the simpler portions, the scope, fee, and schedule for that agreement, the kind of important highlight details. Bill, if you can scroll down there. So what you have, again, here is the kind of the summary of the scope that will be completed at the bottom there on the letter, the itemized list there, at the bottom of this page onto the next page. Keep going there, Bill. Those are the scope. Essentially, it's the design of the trail, and a large portion of this is the bridge itself because it's the spans between the piers on the road bridge. That's a pretty significant portion of the overall work that will be conducted here. Keep going forward there, Bill. Let's see. I think this is the last part of the scope. Yeah. Keep going. Okay, next here, this is the schedule for the project. So if approved here, Shimmer would begin the professional engineering work. Here's the timeline to complete the 30, 60, 90 standard plans and to have the project let by November of 2021 and construction starting in the spring of 2022. And that follows the timeline from the original interlocal agreement and the agreement with NDOT to construct this federal aid project. So this design should be able to meet that timeline, including you can see the complete NEPA. That's a key milestone in a federal aid project, is to have that environmental documentation done so you can move forward with the rest of the design work. Keep going there. And then the last key detail here is the breakdown on the fee, and the bottom line number there is $228,000 as the fee for the professional engineering portion. As a reminder, this is a federal aid project, and when we signed the agreement with NDOT, our estimate originally was $300,000 on the professional engineering. So this is less than what we had expected for the engineering portion of this. And as a federal aid project, 80% of the funding comes from federal sources through MAPA, and then gets implemented here. 20% of the funding comes from local funds. On this project in particular, that 20% is then broken down between the six agencies, and the NRD has agreed to half of that 20%, meaning 10% of the overall cost of the project. So 10% of the $228,000 would be from the NRD over the course of the scope of this project. So we have budgeted for this work in the next fiscal year and then the following roughly fiscal year as well. And so this is within what we had originally expected. For the cost here. Our agreement with NDOT specified an additional professional services agreement that is in process or in negotiation now for the NEPA, for the environmental documentation, and HDR is negotiating that with NDOT now, so we would expect that agreement next month so that they can begin on the environmental engineering work as well. So what we have here is the scope, fee, schedule, and the entire agreements. Again, I have the whole document if anybody has additional questions. For Shimmer to begin and work on the design of this bridge and the adjacent, or the, I'm sorry, the connected trail portion. Most of it is just to the north of the bridge. In order to, yeah, there you go, you can see, connect from the public access Allied Road down to the public access at Beach Road. There have been some changes in the area with the flooding. We are coordinating with Cass County. There had been some discussion about Beach Road. It was under a lot of sand and sediment and debris, and we want to make sure that they keep Beach Road open as a public access point for the south end of this trail, and so we're working with those partners again. Since there are six agencies here, we're coordinating everybody to make sure that we all stay focused on getting this project completed, and so we want to make sure that Beach Road remains open and a public access to reach this public facility. So, again, this is the agreement for the professional services with Shimmer on the design of the trail.
Thank you. We have recommendation.
So moved.
Second.
Second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Caesar?
How much is Laurel Path South for you?
I think 5%. I don't have that. There was a, before we started any agreements with NDOT, there was an interlocal agreement. That was about a year and a half ago. I think that it was Papio 10%, Laurel Platte South 5%, and then Cass, Sarpy, Bellevue, Plattsmith at something like 2, 2, 1, and 1%. So Laurel Platte South is doing, I think about 5% is their portion. We did, the counties and the cities have agreed to take on some of the ongoing operations and maintenance. So any snow plowing that would be done on the bridge after it's on the trail portion of the bridge after it's constructed, and then it, sweeping, snow plowing, essentially the kind of day-to-day maintenance stuff. And then all of the parties, in the event of something more structural needing to be done, would come back together to decide how that would be done, kind of like what we're doing with the lead bridge right now after the flood damage. So the O&M stuff would be handled by other parties. That's why we're handling some of the upfront stuff, and they would take over from there.
So when you cross the bridge, where do you go? Into Shilling?
Yeah, that would be a separate project from this.
And we do have a new Platte River going through Shilling right now.
Yep, and that's a little further, if you see the bottom side of the map there. Yeah, a little further to the east, but the connection down to Beach Road is the function of this project. We're not looking outside of just connecting from the public access at Allied to Beach on this project. That's what's defined in the agreement with NDOT right now, and so we need to stay within the scope of from the public access on the north to the public access on the south. Additional connectivity in the area with the levee project on our side and with something that Lower Platte South and Cass County and Plattsmouth might come up with in the area of Shilling would be done separately in the future.
But you can get to Plattsmouth via whatever roads. I know there's roads down there. But.
Yep. Yeah, so Beach Road does continue a ways further south, and there are public roads that go down to Plattsmouth that are relatively lower traffic and not the highway. And so people do ride on those now. And the fact that this is being upgraded to a higher functional classification means that you will no longer be allowed to ride or walk on the highway bridge or the freeway bridge. So we do need to provide an alternate. NDOT is responsible to provide an alternate access, which is why they installed the girders. So again, a collaboration on they know they need to provide some access here to keep people from walking on the side of that higher speed, higher traffic volume highway. And so we're working with them to get this accomplished.
Great. You mentioned the schedule is in compliance with the on the bridge itself, or we can't. And then we got NEPA in here and dealing with NEPA for a couple of years. Is that because of the bureaucracy crap we have to go through in Lincoln?
So the schedule with NDOT is.
Are you Matt back there, by the way?
I'm sorry, the consultants are here. If you have questions for Chairman, HDR would be the consultant on the NEPA portion. They're not here this evening. They'll probably be here next month. But the timeline with NDOT is based on their work and the agreement that they would do the girders on the bridge when they did the road closure to do the resurfacing on the bridge, which you might have seen if you were in the area. So they have done a significant amount of work, something like $1 million worth of work, to install the girders on the bridge already. And in exchange, and there was no local contribution to that portion of the project. And so in exchange, we now have a timeline to complete this project. Because they had made an investment, they want to make sure their investment ends up being utilized in a finished project.
So this is in line with what others are doing. I mean, it shouldn't take that long anyway. But
yeah, the environmental
kind of tied portion, in with other.
Yeah, the environmental portion should be pretty simple. It should be the abutments just on the end. Since we aren't tying into the bridge abutments, we'll have new abutments on the banks of the Platte River. That should be most of the environmental scope, and that should be pretty straightforward.
Okay, so, but that. Project gets let November 2021, and then construction of the actual trail will be, who knows, took in another year.
Probably any tree clearing would probably be in the winter then, and expected construction start in 2022, spring of 2022, and the timeline on this should go relatively fast. I would expect
1 year to construct the trail and those, because most of the bridge work is already done, and all we're doing is building a trail on top of the bridge and some aesthetic features that are going to be part of this.
You related to Chuck? Are you related to Chuck Schmidler?
I am. Not my uncle.
Any other questions?
Afterwards. Director
Jeff? Has there ever been a ballpark estimate of the actual construction? Range.
Yeah, so the original estimate for the entire project was about $4 million. The girders ended up being a little less, like I said, somewhere around $1 million. NDOT didn't itemize that. The estimate on the agreement with NDOT was $2 million for the design and construction of the entire project. Again, 20% local. So $400,000 is the expected total local contribution, meaning that $200,000 would be the expected total Papio NRD contribution. This is a little lower than our estimate. The original estimate, that $2 million, was pretty conservative. We do expect that we would be able to come in under that $2 million estimate, and we'll know more as we move through the design as to what that construction cost is.
Probably.
Yes, and yeah. So our fiscal, our budget 2022 would probably have the construction portion of our funding. So we would have 2 more years before we get to that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Jeff?
Yes.
Sapinski?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Aye. And that completes the program projects and operations. Okay.
Anybody need that for it? We will call the meeting of the FDL subcommittee in order at 7:47. Notification of the Open Meeting Act it is posted in the back and outside in the hallway. With that, item 3, quorum call.
Bradley?
Here.
Bradley?
Here.
McCormick?
Here.
Lee?
Here.
And Chairperson?
Here. Adoption of the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Roll call.
Bradley?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Lee?
Yes.
Begley?
Yes.
And Chairperson?
Yes. And as is standard, when I run a meeting, I will impose a 3-minute time limit from the general public making statements per person. With that, review number item 6, review of the FY 2020 budget, draft 1. John,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. As during the budget workshop, we discussed in more detail, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. I won't go through all that again. Obviously, attached is a draft a 2020 budget. As you're aware, the budget is a guide for the planning for expenditures of each fiscal year. A quick overview, total operating budget proposed is $84.2 million. Property tax levy, 0.037594. Property tax requirement, $25,940,840. Property valued at $100,000 would be $37.59 a year. We did base the estimate on the valuation increase of 4.5%. Again, final valuations are not provided by the counties until mid-August. Last year's final valuations were a 5.19% increase. The following items that you'd like to consider, $500,000 has been budgeted for necessary cash reserve. Again, this is less than a month of operations for the district. And there's $9,218,381 as estimated for general cash on hand as of June 30th, 2019. This is the first draft, so no doubt draft 2 will change, as there are several unknowns. In fact, Amanda had an adjustment to the Platte River Landing figures due to that we have final bids now. Final revenue expenditures, cash on hand, treasurer's balance, valuations, etc., are not finalized and will be later through the summer. Hopefully, the budget figures get us in the ballpark for compliance with state statutes, the 2.5% lid specifically. And I would ask everybody to review the budget. If you have any questions or need me to a meeting to sit down and go over in more detail, just let me know. I'll be more than happy to provide you that information or opportunity to sit down and discuss it. So dates to remember, August 6th, FDL subcommittee meeting review the second draft. And then we have a public input meeting at the August 8th board meeting. And then the budget hearings and adoption will and set the tax levy are at the September 12th. 2019 board meeting.
Any remarks or comments from the board? No action necessary, is it?
No, it's just review.
Anybody from the general public? Moving on, thank you. Item 7, review and recommendation of 2020 budget lid compensation. 1%, John
Rinkle. Thank you, sir. State statutes requires that no government unit shall adopt a budget containing a total budgeted restricted funds of more than last year's prior total budget restricted funds plus allowable increases. All political subdivisions have the ability to increase their base restricted funds by 2.5%. If you want to exceed that, you need a 2/3 majority or 3/4 majority of the board, which would be 9 out of 11. Or the supermajority that's present at the board meeting during the vote. An increase in restricted funds does not mean a tax increase. And so we've had several conversations with the state auditor's office. And so what the additional 1% allows, it is allows the district more flexibility in our budgeting and to control general costs. For example, the restricted fund, the lid applies to the general expenditures listed on the memo. So you have a director's per diem, district insurance coverage, which we already said is going to increase 5%, equipment and vehicles, salaries and payroll taxes, building maintenance, park and structure maintenance. So again, this is our maintenance of our dams, levees, and then the conservation assistance payments, gas, oil, and vehicle repairs, utilities. And then we have LID exceptions, payments on bonded debt are not calculated in the LID, capital improvements and acquisition of real property, interlocal agreements, which we have a number of, and repairs to infrastructure damaged by natural disaster, which we have this year. So by not approving the additional 1% every year, you basically, you hem in the district a little bit, and what it could possibly do is we have to start cutting either into maintenance, or you may get to the point where you're so tight against the lid that you have to start leasing vehicles instead of purchasing, or leasing equipment instead of purchasing it, to be able to stay under that 2.5% requirement. So we put a list of the votes and how they occurred in the past to authorize the additional 1%. And obviously we are recommending the additional 1% as it gives us the flexibility to budget and to control costs. And we would recommend the approval. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? We get a motion on the floor, please?
John,
Preston or motion?
I got a question.
Go ahead.
I don't see where we would really need to raise anything, because we've got a $9 million carryover. So why in the world do we need to add more money to something that we've got excess money sitting there anyway?
It doesn't apply to you how much cash you have in or carryover or anything. It applies to what those categories are that are in the restricted fund category. So it doesn't matter if you had $30 million on hand. It's not going to.
But it does. Indirectly, it does. I don't see it. I don't see where we would want to raise it.
Gary, did you want to add anything? You're good at this.
Okay. So, I can do this. The district is subject to 4.5% levy limit. And within that levy, we are subject to our restricted funds authority. So we get a certain base amount of dollars that we can levy. So basically, everything is restricted funds that is not restricted funds, and we get exceptions for the debt payments, capital improvements, interlocal agreements, and of course, that encompasses most of what we do in our budget any given year. Like John said, the maintenance falls under restricted funds and salaries, building maintenance, all the riprap, and it adds up. And the 2.5% increase that we get to that base authority every year doesn't necessarily keep up with inflation. And since most of what we do is covered by the capital improvements and the interlocal agreements, we've never been squeezed super tight, but you want to stay ahead of it. And if you allow yourself the extra 1% increase every year, then you're just giving yourself more flexibility within the same levy to allocate it to what you want to fund any given year. It just gives you more choices. You don't have to spend any more money on any one certain thing, but in some instances, it means you could if you wanted to. And I don't think flexibility is ever negative.
Nice work. I understand now.
There you go. Better now. That's why I take her to the Capitol.
can see on the board behind you the list of items that it impacts. Any further comments?
I still say if you're going to go for a 1% increase, that standard or whatever you want to call it, I still say that let's manage this like a business and stick with it. I think we are spending entirely too much money on certain things. Let's just manage it. That's where I'm at with it. I don't see you going 2.5%. And I know everybody's done this every year, but at some point we're responsible for what we're spending here. And I think we need to kind of get our arms around it a little bit once in a while.
Actually, we've only done it 3 years out of the past 10, I think, or 9.
Yeah, it doesn't appear we've done it very often, but it gives you more flexibility to cover the increase in insurance costs.
Right.
And those items, if there's no more money added to the budget, it just gives you the flexibility to move it within the budget. Is that the simple?
Not exactly.
Yeah, it gives you flexibility to increase.
It doesn't add to the budget. It just allows you to move it within.
It's a raise and increase of money.
No, it's a raise in the items.
It does not automatically increase your authority at all.
And you have the directors have to decide that they want to increase those, and you have that flexibility when it comes time if you need to do that. But I'd motion that we accept that. I'll second.
Further comments?
I still look at the overall budget. We've got $84 million budgeted, and that's an increase of over $12 million from last year, and we can't live on that. We have 1%. That just seems kind of excessive. Hard time selling that to my constituents. So.
Any further comments?
Director's comments, or the public had a chance yet, or what? When you get back to the fair zone. Oh, there's no public comment?
Yes.
Not in this one.
Oh, okay. This is within our existing budget. It's not like we're going to save money if we don't do this. Not that we're going to spend more money if we do increase the lid. It's a lid within our current budget. It doesn't increase the costs of our budget. What it would require, if any of these categories hit the lid, what we have, whether it's maintenance, payroll taxes, what you see up there, gas and oil, we don't know what's going to happen next year with nationwide what's going on with the election and all that. So what this does allows us for flexibility within that budget to move dollars around like we currently have. But these categories are important. Now, I've got it in all my years on the board. Of those years we did approve it, we have managed, and we never had an increase of 1%. But I feel we've got to give the tool available to management to, just in case the equipment and vehicles and insurance covers go skyrocketing up in the next year, how are we going to manage that? Well, we had a 2.5% lid, but if we allow another 1%, we can manage it even better by taking away from something else. So it's within our current budget. So it's not a bad deal, not a bad tool. It's not increased taxes, and just allows us within these categories to manage better.
What happens, John, when the air conditioner clocks out that you're cutting out of the budget? Obviously,
building maintenance, it's a lid.
Certainly, it would have an impact.
Oh, things like that, all those things. Salaries, all those things that you really have no control over, a little bit, but it gives you that flexibility.
It gives us flexibility. Any further comments?
Structured maintenance, would that include the dam spillways and all of them?
The bigger.
Right. Riprap and everything. So the daily, weekly, monthly, yearly maintenance, not the huge project, but those. So yeah, those, as those get more expensive, and as the flood demonstrated, there's going to be more of that in the future. We have more scour holes, we have more erosion, we have more sloughing. Those will tend to increase as well.
Definitely have a lot of referrals.
Rich, Director Keyser, just to be clear, this is providing flexibility, right? That's what I understand, General Manager.
Okay, thank you. We won't come back with draft two and it's 1% higher. So.
Any further comment? Roll call.
Yes.
Reese?
No.
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Yes. Please. I believe that concludes our agenda, doesn't it?